Welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, a state audit faults the Utah Inland Port for awarding no-bid contracts and for accountability issues. The Salt Lake City Council fast-tracks some proposed zoning changes and changes to rules to off-street parking and tiny homes in what it says is an effort to address affordability. And Utah River Guides work to combat sexual harassment on the water. Joining me for this conversation, all via the Zoom this morning, we've got Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson. Leah, thanks very much for making time for this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Of course. Good morning. Investigative reporter Jessica Miller is with us. Good morning to you, Jessica, and thanks for doing this.
Of course. Good morning.
Good morning. And Tribune real estate reporter Tony Semerad is also with us. Hi, Tony. Thanks for joining.
Hey, good morning, everybody.
And news columnist Robert Gerke, much obliged, Roger. Robert, appreciate your being here. I'm Roger.
Yeah, happy to be here, Roger. Thanks.
You're welcome. Listeners, you can join this conversation by tweeting to us. The handle is at KCPW, or you can call us up at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Leah Larson, we're going to turn to a kind of perennial topic that we discuss on this show, the Inland Port. Legislative auditors dinged the Inland Port for, why don't I let you tell us for what? Audits typically look at, you know, monetary expenditures, and this audit has a fair amount to say about that, but also about transparency and about competitive bidding and so on. Leah, can you tell us just what, you know, who conducted this audit and then maybe give us the top line story of what it found?
Okay, yeah. So if you'll recall, the legislature shook up leadership at the Inland Port Authority earlier this year and gave it a new board. And one of the first things that the board did was commission this legislative audit. So it's a limited audit. They only had a little bit of time, but I think, you know, the findings were interesting, but maybe not necessarily surprising to some of us who have been following this. For example, they found that the board has not been as involved as it could be in some of the big decisions and spending at the Port Authority. It found that there's kind of a lack of transparency, and that has led to all these no-bid contracts. And basically, a lot of state agencies have to go through the procurement process, so they have to solicit bids when they spend state public funds.
Right.
But for some reason, the legislature carved out an exception for the Port Authority. But this audit found, and so the Port Authority doesn't necessarily have to go through the procurement process, but this audit found that it overly relied on that exception and had dozens of no-bid contracts. And, you know, the Tribune had reported on a couple of these earlier this year, multi-million dollar contracts that never went out to bid. But I guess what was surprising, at least to me, was how extensive it was, just how many contracts there were.
Right. And Leah, I mean, again, you said you've written about this before. There was this, the Tribune reported on this no-bid contract for a kind of, AI / information gathering camera entity called Quaychain.
Actually pronounced Keychain. But
Keychain. Oh, key. Right. Okay. Quay. Thank you. The key. Keychain. That makes sense. Okay. Quay chain. I remember there was a quote from a computer science professor at the University of Utah in your article that said that his students could easily have made what this company was offering, but, you know, they got a couple million dollars for their no bid contract. That was just one of a number of examples. And this audit, you know, that you reported on, it unearthed a few more as you just said, you were surprised by the extent of it. What other kinds of deals, you know, worth millions of dollars are we talking about here that were no bid contracts?
Gosh, well, so another one beyond Keychain that we had reported on was the site of the transloading facility. So they had signed a lease where they were paying like $120,000 a month to lease this piece of ground that's just vacant, where they had planned to build a transloading facility, which struck me as kind of strange, because generally when you build a multi-million dollar state facility, the state would want to own that ground. So that was one we had reported on, but there were a few others, like this lease to own of like a rail spur that they spent like $8 million on, and then road construction that they spent $10 million on. I mean, they haven't, that was a contract. They haven't spent that much yet. They spent something like $4 million on that contract so far. But the audit pointed out that that was kind of weird because generally road projects are at least partly funded by developers. So they it wasn't quite clear why the Port Authority was paying, like shelling out to cover the whole entire road. So well, those are some of the big ticket ones. But, you know, and there were a bunch of smaller ones as well.
Yeah. And that's, yeah, right. We can maybe skip over the smaller ones. But yeah, the $10 million contract with the group to build a road and that being generally funded by developers and the audit being the auditors kind of wondering why the port itself was just paying for that. They also said that, you know, going back to Keychain, I'll pronounce it correctly this time, that logistics, you know, camera technology company with cameras that are installed to look at truck traffic in the Northwest Quadrant and maybe kind of analyze that it has exceeded its contract by more than $1.7 million. And then auditors had questions about the relationship between the now former head of the Inland Port, Jack Hedge, and the CEO of this company, Keychain. Can you sort of tell us, I mean, what did they say about that?
Yeah, so this was kind of, I guess, it reinforced a question that I had when I was reporting the story, because I was looking into the CEO of Keychain and what were his qualifications. Like, he's not a computer programmer. He's not, you know, in the tech industry, but the former executive director told me that he, you know, this company has qualifications that no other company in the world can do. But to me, it just seemed like they were pulling like off the shelf products like cameras with AI in them and just, you know, like basically anything that anybody with basic programming skills could do. So as I was looking into this guy, it appears that he and the former executive director used to work together at another port in California. So they have some kind of business ties. And that is more or less what the audit concluded as well.
Again, as we said, he's the now former head, because there have been these changes at the Inland Port Authority. And maybe we can, I mean, I still have to ask this question that we've been asking since the beginning, which is, what is this thing, Leah? I mean, we're talking about these no-bid contracts, a lot of expenditure, but what is the, you know, like every time we try and grapple with what the Inland Port is, transloading facility, moving stuff from one place to another, a place for goods to clear customs, but is it very clear what the port, you know, sort of mission is?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And that was actually another big finding of this audit, that the port has never really had a comprehensive plan as to what it is and what it wants to do. So that was a big thing that it got dinged for. So now the new executive director, who just took the previous executive director's place this month, he has canceled or put on pause almost all of these contracts. And they are going to start with a master planning process. So they have kind of a guiding star as to what this thing is and what they're going to do, which I think is important. It has a lot of support.
What about these contracts that already exist that are these, you know, no bid millions of dollars of contracts to various entities?
So most of those have been put on hold, the exception being the lease on that transloading facility, which sounds to me that there will not be a transloading facility. They are abandoning that plan. So now that they can't get out of this contract, it will be interesting to see what they do with that piece of property.
Okay. Lee, I'm going to put you on hold for just a minute and bring in the news columnist, Robert Gerke. And Robert, you know, public funding being spent in opaque or confusing ways. And then, you know, the example that that was brought up of friends paying friends or, you know, former colleagues from other places. Maybe that's just the Utah way, Robert. I don't know if it's the right thing to do, obviously. Maybe I'll let you comment on this. I'm sort of talking over you.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a reason we go through procurement process when we're spending public money, and that's to make sure we're getting the best product at the best cost and that public money's being used, you know, appropriately and correctly, and there's not conflicts of interest. All of these are safeguards that have been in place in government procurement for decades. And the notion that the legislature was in such a hurry to get this done that they gave this the Inland Port Authority a special dispensation and a way around some of these, I mean, you see what happens, you know, and so we do end up in a situation where there are now legitimate questions about a lot of these contracts. A lot of them are being put on hold. You're going back and having to do them again. And it kind of also stems from, as Lee was just referring to, the rush to try to get all of this done. without knowing what it is. You know, going back to the question you asked, what is it? And so, and you end up with this hodgepodge, and you know, corners get cut, and it's unfortunate. I am hopeful, you know, that with this audit, with the new leadership in place, that we can, you know, that some of this can be avoided in the future. But yeah, I mean, it's not a good look for an entity that hasn't really been very transparent in the first place, and really evasive about answering the fundamental questions of what it's doing and how it's doing it. So, I mean, kudos to Leah for highlighting some of the earlier ones. I'm glad the auditor found these others, and hopefully, you know, we can clean things up and figure out where we're going with this and how we're going to get there.
Yeah, it is interesting. I'm curious about the dispensation that you mentioned and how that got put into place in the first place. You said Robert kind of mentioned the idea that it was because they were trying to fast track this thing, and that somehow that would free up the port to, I guess, act more quickly. Though it seems like we've been doing this for years, a spending freeze for now, you know, from the new heads of this organization, it seems like they didn't have a choice after this audit did. What, Leah, I guess maybe what I'll ask you here is, what else do we need to know about this story and where it's headed? I mean, how long is that freeze in place? When will the master plan document that they're working on come out or come to light?
It's not exactly clear. Master plans take a long time, so we shall see. But I guess I would also note that the whole reason the state took over the inland port jurisdiction area from Salt Lake City is because they claim the state can manage it better than the city. And so far, it doesn't seem like that's the case.
All right. Leah Larson is a land and water use reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, and you can find her reporting over at sltrib.com. You can also subscribe to her to the Tribune at sltrib.com. We're going to take a quick break on the show. When we come back, we will turn to a story about the culture of river guiding in Utah and who is working to change it. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune water and land use reporter Leah Larson, investigative reporter Jessica Miller, real estate reporter Tony Semerad, and by news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our live Friday morning Utah News Wrap-Up, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling us up at 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. The handle is at KCPW. Jessica Miller, you wrote this really in-depth piece about the culture of river guiding here in Utah, and actually not just in Utah, but focusing on Utah. And it's something that has a long history in the state, especially on the Green and Colorado rivers, but elsewhere too, meaning river guiding itself. And your story starts off with a guide who talked about the kinds of comments that she would get on the river from men, especially from people who were clients as she was rowing in her boats. And anyway, she's pushing back now as part of an intentional culture shift. This is Tyler Jamison. Can you tell us about her experience and the comments that she used to get, which you used to kind of introduce the topic of harassment on the river?
Yeah, so she would often get, and a lot of women that I spoke to often would get these kind of comments where she's, you know, guiding a boat and a male customer will say like, oh, do you want me to take a turn rowing? Like they'll make like comments about the size of their body and they, you know, I can't believe a woman your size could row a boat this big, you know, the comments that might seem, you know, not sexual harassment, but it's sexism, right? Like male customers were perceiving that because they were women, because their bodies were smaller, they weren't strong enough to do their jobs, which is to be professional river guides, to, you know, have the knowledge to guide boats through rapids and to keep their clients safe. And, you know, obviously the body strength to be able to do that as well. And so a lot of the women I talked with had this kind of baseline experience of people talking a lot about the sizes of their bodies or making comments about being women. But then there were, you know, behaviors that also become a bit more dark, as Tyler had kind of explained it, where you know, on the river. I mean, these are multi-day river trips a lot of times. And so the guides are sleeping in tents next to clients, next to other guides. They're eating together. I mean, they're living with the customers for multiple days. And so in those environments where you're, you know, sleeping together in really remote places, a lot of times, you know, you're done rafting, you might want to have a couple of beers. So it can be kind of a party atmosphere. There's definitely been allegations and discussions of behavior that's crossed the line into sexual harassment or even sexual assault.
Yeah. Tyler Jamieson, who your story starts with, works for Holiday River Expeditions, which is a sort of storied guide service in Green River. You also spoke with Lauren Wood, whose grandfather founded that company. But can we talk about how, I mean, I guess maybe how prevalent harassment is in general? I know there have been some reports on that topic from, like, you know, you're describing the conversations you had with people who are telling you directly what happened to them. But then there have been, you know, sort of investigations, reports on this topic from the Interior Department, for example, and also from a Utah Valley University professor. Can you sort of give us the lay of the land there, Jessica?
Yeah. So, you know, the outdoor industry has risk factors that that federal agencies say can lead to harassment because, you know, you've got this young workforce, there's this reliance on customer satisfaction, and your workplaces are often like remote or very isolated because you're out on these multi-day river trips. And the Interior Department did a investigation in 2016 after some employees at the Grand Canyon National Park had complained about some river guides that are being really inappropriate with a lot of the women there. And so they documented these kind of explosive allegations about, you know, harassment and possible assault happening in Grand Canyon. And there's a professor here at Utah Valley University named Maria Blevins. She's a former river guide. And when she read that research, or when she read that report, she was like, oh my gosh, like, I know those guys. I thought they were so cool. And then as she thought about it, she's like, well, you know, except for that time they asked us to go topless down this rapid, or the time that, you know, he was trying to get into my tent. And at that moment, she didn't realize that those behaviors were inappropriate. It hadn't really fazed her. She was just like, well, this is kind of like what river life is like. This is what you do. And so it was kind of that experience and that like reckoning with her own experiences that led her to research this. And she's found that, you know, women in the river guiding industry have been hazed at work, or they're kind of told to, you know, shrug off crude jokes. They oftentimes feel unsafe during these overnight trips when men, which are both, you know, their customers and also their fellow guides, might make unwanted sexual advances when, you know, the night's done and it seems like you're kind of off, you're having a couple beers or whatever. And these like unwanted sexual advances are happening. And what she found is that because of this environment, because of this like toxic male culture, women who are talented at their jobs or talented at guiding often just leave because it's such a toxic work environment.
Right. Right. Forcing people out of the industry altogether, Blevin says. Yeah, and how unfortunate that is. You know, there's a concerted now. I mean, this is, maybe we'll turn to the kind of thrust of your story. The brunt of what you are describing is this concerted, organized effort to address, you know, these problems and that culture that you just described that has been emerging. Some of it is informal. Some of it is formal trainings. Can you describe what that looks like? Who is leading that effort? I'm sure it's not just one entity, but yeah, can you describe that?
Yeah. So the goal is to, you know, give training so that both men and women who work in this industry can recognize like sexual harassment or sexism quickly and learn how to address it by either, you know, diverting the conversation or kind of addressing it head on. You know, they're given all of these different skills or different angles they can use to kind of nip these behaviors in the bud. Because from some of the interviews that I did, it seems like a lot of times it might start with like an inappropriate comment or a sexist comment, and then nobody pushes back on that. And so the behavior tends to escalate. And so the idea is if you kind of, you know, tell the person who might be inappropriate very quickly, hey, that's not okay, but this is not what we like talk about here. This isn't what we do, you know, on this trip. then they can stop some of these behaviors. And so Holiday River Expeditions does training with all of their employees now, or all of their river guides. There's also a group, the Colorado Plateau River Guides, which is a nonprofit guides who work in Moab and more in the Southwest US. They all are part of this organization. And they did a training trip for guides where they would, you know, they taught them about astronomy and biology and camp life, like things that you would need to know as a guide. But there was a night where they specifically talked about sexual harassment and sexism, which, you know, I talked with a lot of guides who've been in the industry for a long time. They said they've never talked about this before, and they've never really addressed this, even though they saw it happening throughout their careers.
Yeah, and again, some of these trainings are taking place for guides on the river as they do sort of colloquia or you know, having a meeting on the river. Going back to someone that I mentioned before in your story, Lauren Wood of Holiday River Expeditions, they talked about there being a code of conduct that clients have to sign. And I don't know if that's a new thing in the industry, or if that is something that they're sort of pioneering.
I know it's a new thing for Holiday River. Lauren kind of spearheaded that effort, and they've been really instrumental in implementing that training. And they're also doing, you know, guided trips for the LGBTQ community and like people of color, so that they feel like they have a safe space to be on the river. And, you know, Lauren said that's kind of the whole goal of all of this, is to, like, a whole point of a river trip is to go and get in touch with nature and feel like you can be safe. And so, you know, as employers, they feel like it's their responsibility to help create that safer environment for both the clients and their employees.
You know, you talked about people, the UVU professor talking about people being chased out of the industry, women in particular being chased out of the industry. But your story ends, Jessica, with the fact that guiding itself is changing, because actually it is becoming a less, you know, dude-centric place than it used to be in the world of guiding. And I think I'm quoting somebody from your article, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
How is it changing? And tell us about that.
Yeah. So my photographer and I went down to Moab for this story, and, you know, we kind of milled around different guide shops and met a lot of people, and everyone we talked to said, oh yeah, our guiding is about 50-50 now, half men, half women, which is way different from the 90s, when having, like, you know, one or two women was about all you would see in a river guiding company. And so they're seeing a presentation change. I mean, we kind of drove up and down the Colorado River too, and just looking around, you saw the people who are working, the people who are unloading the boats and guiding these trips. It was about a 50-50 split. There was as many women who were guiding trips that I saw as men. And so we're seeing more women entering this industry, and hopefully through these types of trainings and this culture change, hopefully now they'll be staying if they want to.
It's a really remarkable, the series of photographs too from Leah Hoxton and your trip on the river are really worth checking out at sltrip.com. Maybe I'll stick you on hold for a second here, Jessica, bring the news columnist in. Though, Robert, I don't know if it makes a great deal of sense to ask you a question here. It might be worth, I suppose, saying that, you know, something about the idea of the fact that they're talking about nudging people toward better behavior on the river. That doesn't just have to happen, you know, in the world of river guiding. That can be any place where harassment might occur. What are your thoughts about this reporting?
Yeah, I mean, I think we are seeing an evolution that's taking place over time. And you know, some places are doing it a little faster than others. I thought this was a great story. I thought, and I'm encouraged that they're doing it because it is changing. I mean, I just in the, you know, the last decade, you've seen the makeup of who's on the river changing fairly considerably. And I think it's important that as that change occurs, people are addressing these issues that arise. I mean, I think that the passage that stuck with me is the one you referenced a couple times, that people previously were just leaving if these women didn't feel like they were safe or you know, if it was a hostile environment. So it's really encouraging that we're seeing it, and hopefully it, you know, makes the river a more enjoyable, equitable place.
Yeah. And again, I think that there's that sort of take the lessons from the story and apply them anywhere or any industry. I mean, Jessica talked about the sort of dude centric, or Jessica didn't, but somebody in her article talked about the fact that there was this culture of harassment that existed on the river. That's obviously not unique to the river, but maybe was more prevalent there and is being addressed head on. That can be addressed head on anywhere that it occurs. Jessica Miller, it's kind of hard to get to everything that you reported in the story into our discussion just because we are crunched on time. But again, I'll encourage people to check out your story and the great photography by Leah Hogston. Since we can't get to the whole of the story, is there anything else that you'd want, you'd really want listeners to know about this reporting? We do have a couple of minutes here.
Well, I think we covered everything, so.
Sorry, putting you on the spot, that's a really tough question to ask. Well, again, check it out at sltrip.com. We were discussing that reporting that was done by Jessica Miller on river guiding and addressing harassment in that industry head on. And it's great reporting. I'll remind listeners that you are tuned to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. And, you know, I'm going to squeeze in another story about water here, actually, and bring Leah Larson back into the conversation. Leah, I'm going to spring a story on you just really quickly that I didn't tell you I was going to ask you about, which is the fact that there is this effort to address salinity on the Great Salt Lake by sort of changing this thing that runs across the center of the Great Salt Lake, which is the causeway. What are they doing to try and address salinity? And how are they? This is the old railway causeway that cuts between the two halves of the lake, and they're sort of adjusting it to try and deal with a major problem out there.
Yeah. So it used to be this wood trestle railroad, and they like in the '50s, I think, filled it in with rocks, and that effectively cut the north arm off from any sources of fresh water, which is why it's like a dark kind of purpley color up there, and the rest of the lake is a green blue color. But they created a breach so that the water could circulate, but now they're kind of like, oh, we don't want all that salty water migrating south because it's spiking the salinity, and that's not good for the brine shrimp, it's not good for the bugs, it's not good for the birds. So in July, they dropped a bunch of rocks essentially at this breach to raise it up a little bit so the water seepage is not so strong, I guess. Yeah.
Does that mean that the north arm of the lake becomes even saltier? I mean, over time?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of at saturation. It can't really get any saltier than it is right now. Like, it's so salty that the salt is just kind of like falling out of the water and like collecting on the bottom.
Wow.
But yeah, it's not getting any fresh water to make it less saline.
Okay. And then, I mean, there's quite a lot to talk about with the lake, but that I will direct people to your reporting at sltrip.com. There's also the Tribune, KCPW, and other entities, including Utah Public Radio, belong to the Great Salt Lake Collaborative, trying to highlight issues facing the lake and try and present solutions for them. And that's something we can talk about on a future show. But for now, I think I will bring us to another break in the show. There is still more to come, including when we come back, we'll turn to a story about proposed zoning changes for Salt Lake City and its neighborhoods. And why not? We'll also talk about dissatisfaction over a gas station that is slated to take over a vacant lot near to Sugar House Park. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Leah Larson, Jessica Miller, Tony Semerad, and Robert Gerke. This is our Friday morning Utah News Roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. You can also tweet them to @KCPW. And Tony Semerad, I'm going to bring you into the conversation now. Thank you for your patience. Tony Semerad covers real estate for the Salt Lake Tribune, and Tony, I want to start with the suite of proposals that the Salt Lake City Council is considering on zoning. And some of this has to do with parking and new apartment buildings, meaning when and where you build and how much parking you construct. Some of it has to do with changing where people, you know, can actually build certain kinds of housing. And then there's tiny homes and more. All of these changes that we'll get to are being fast-tracked, apparently, by the council. And maybe the first question that I have for you, actually, is why the council wants to move quickly on all of these changes. Is that a good place to start, Tony?
Sure. I mean, there is definitely a sense of things sort of stepping up with regard to housing at City Hall. And I think probably the biggest impetus there is, you know, the council and the mayor are seeing this pretty dramatic upsurge in homelessness around the city and a bunch of related problems. And there's this sense of really wanting to pursue, well, basically recognizing there's no one solution to the affordable housing problem, but that they're going to have to throw a bunch of small solutions at it and attack it from a bunch of different sides. And I think that's why you're seeing this resurrection of a bunch of ideas that the council has really talked about for 3 or 4 years in some cases, but now they want to get going on these ideas.
Is there, Tony, an easy way to summarize what these changes do? I mean, you break this down into several categories in your story: shared housing, off-street parking, and then smaller homes or zoning for lots in a certain area of the city or certain parts of the city, I guess. What does this do? Maybe we can do this one by one. What does this do for shared housing? What is this proposal about?
Well, okay, so this represents a certain kind of dormitory style housing. There are some examples around Salt Lake City. This used to be a lot more common, you know, before, say, 1980, when there were literally thousands of these units around this. These used to be called single resident occupancy units, SROs, and were a place where you could get a nightly or a weekly kind of rental of a room, probably with some kind of a shared facility, either the kitchen or the bathroom or the living room. They've essentially been zoned out of existence in the city and were considered a pretty crucial piece in keeping people vulnerable to homeless from landing on the street. The city was actually in the business of subsidizing these SROs at one point. And this move represents a pretty dramatic expansion of where these kinds of facilities would be allowed, almost quadrupling the acreage around the city where you can build these facilities. And back in the day and up until now, they've been controversial in some neighborhoods. They do bring a certain impact with them, and that was part of the discussion when these were called SROs back in the day. And this one's been on the city's agenda for almost 3 or 4 years and been set aside a number of times along the way just because there are these kind of controversial elements to it.
Well, you know, you mentioned the fact that they were, you know, quote unquote, practically zoned out of existence. I know that there are still some examples here in the city of these SRO, you know, of what's being proposed now as shared housing. Do you have a sense of why and how they were zoned out of existence? Basically why the city almost did away with them?
Well, I mean, some of it was the city's own actions. There was a significant cluster of these over on State Street, for example, and those torn down as part of the city's 255 state housing project, which is construction's proceeding pretty dramatically, and they're getting close to being done there. But some of the city tore down itself, and again, there, you know, each of these was sort of associated with a certain neighborhood kind of impact from those residents, and they were kind of viewed as undesirable in some neighborhoods only a few years ago. The council's considering some stricter, if you want to call it that, sort of design standards for these, and presumes to get into the business of maybe regulating what these things look like in terms of what facilities people actually have to share and how small the spaces are and that sort of thing. But it was essentially just they were considered kind of undesirable in a lot of neighborhoods back in the day.
Hmm. Where you said this would expand, you know, significantly the places where they could go. Where, I mean, not to create an immediate not in my backyard response, but, you know, where might they go? I know that you highlighted the Bueno Avenue apartments along 700 East and what's happening there in sort of Salt Lake City's northern area. Go ahead. Sure.
these are currently limited primarily to zones close to transit in the city. In a certain kind of form-based zoning area that the city has created relatively recently. And this would expand them essentially to to most residential neighborhoods, it would stay away from some of the more established neighborhoods further up on the East Bench, but a lot of residential neighborhoods kind of down in the bottom part of the valley, a lot of commercial and business districts, and essentially the entire downtown area would be added to where these facilities would be permitted, including a lot of those, you know, neighborhoods that have some sensitive homeowners in them that don't want to see these sorts of things, places like Central City and Liberty Park and Sugar House.
Hmm. Okay, well, so we should probably get to the other parts of the changes that are, proposed. And so let's go to the smaller, or actually, no, let's do the off-street parking requirements. This is about, I think this has to do, if I'm not mistaken, Tony, with, how much parking you are required to build when you are developing something.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the city has had a relatively complicated kind of approach, depending on specific zones and specific land uses as to what kind of parking ratios it requires, whether that's per unit on an, sort of how many parking stalls do you have to allocate for an apartment or on a square footage basis for businesses. And what the city, what this would do is essentially really simplify that. Instead of having all these different flavors of zones and kinds of land use, they'll essentially be four sorts of areas, sorts of contexts in the city, and parking ratios would be set accordingly. I don't think there's any way around the fact that this is certainly going to lower off-street parking requirements for a lot of new developments that are in areas that are close to tracks, and that instantly touches off division among the public. There's a lot of strong sentiment as to whether Salt Lake City has too much or too little parking. It really depends what neighborhood you're in. If you look at the city overall, we've got plenty of parking. It's just a matter of where. But this is thought, it's thought that this is going to give especially developers of multifamily projects, some of these big apartment units, a lot more flexibility in terms of how they can build, and hopefully not only bring more units in, but maybe start edging the price per unit per dwelling down.
Yeah, I've seen, there's developers occasionally say that they charge quite a bit more for, or they have to charge quite a bit more for units because of the cost of building, of constructing parking. The flip side of that, of course, is that people may have to pay for their parking to make up the lack of, options there in a new location. But okay, well, let's thank you for that description. And now I want to just get to the last one here, which is sort of the smaller homes area, or changing what can be built where. This one, Tony, feels a little bit, I mean, all of the zoning stuff is complicated to me, but this one feels a little bit more complicated. What would this change actually do in Salt Lake City?
Well, so Salt Lake City's got about 1,000 of these long, skinny residential lots spread around the city that are zoned a particular way, and about two-thirds of them have single-family homes on them now. What this would do is kind of change the rules for how you build certain categories of smaller homes, things like backyard cottages and side row houses and townhomes and that sort of thing, so that given some concessions on how far they have to be from the neighbor and how they can be configured on the lot, this would allow a lot of this sort of smaller home kind of construction on those existing lots, maybe in the backyard, along the side. And it's sort of a slow way of introducing the idea of density to and what's called the missing middle, this sort of a traditional kind of housing between apartments and homes, single family homes, into some of these neighborhoods in a kind of a gradual way. The big concern about this one is, of course, that by letting homeowners build more on their lots, will this encourage a kind of a worrisome trend we're seeing a lot of, where these existing single family homes that tend to be affordable just because they're older and that sort of thing, maybe we would be encouraging a lot more demolition of those homes, which we are seeing a lot of.
Right.
And so there is some concern on the council with all of these. I mean, if you had to put these all under a single umbrella, this represents the city you know, which has traditionally approached affordable housing in terms of money, right? That they've been willing to invest in these projects to kind of help affordable housing happen. This is a resorting to zoning. This is tweaking what's permitted on land around the city in hopes of encouraging additional housing construction.
Yeah, encouraging density. And the question is, does density actually equate to affordability? And it's just one, I mean, it's one tool in the toolbox, I guess, is to increase the number. You know, you expect that if there's more stock, then there's the market kind of takes over. But the market right now, especially as you describe, sort of critics saying that by allowing redevelopment of properties that you might actually be putting cheaper homes out of, or cheaper potential, you know, the housing that exists now and happens to be naturally cheap, having that be torn down. How quickly are these changes? You said fast-tracked. When might they get approved, and how can people who are listening right now learn more?
Well, there's two answers to that question. These could be approved literally within the coming weeks. And what the council has done is essentially pulled stuff off the shelf that it's had a lot of public hearings about already. There's been a lot of study of these things. And so these are almost the equivalent of shovel-ready policies that where they'll be able to maybe debate them once and pass them. The effects are gonna be a lot more long-term. And that's the case with anything with regard to zoning. You can change what you allow on land, but it's really kind of up to landowners to decide what they want to do. So will this produce a huge infusion of affordable homes overnight? No. And there's really a kind of an unpredictable factor here too, that the city really doesn't know what broad effects this may have, but it's kind of nibbling away at the problem, you know, in smaller bites, if you will.
Okay. I'm going to actually, instead of bringing Robert Gergen on this right now, I'm going to actually keep you, Tony, here because we're low on time. And I want to ask you, I want to squeeze in one more story about real estate, because it's one that I know has stirred a fair amount of questions. I don't know about controversy, but it has some history, too. This is about a parcel of land that sits at the corner of a busy intersection in Sugar House. In fact, it's actually, you know, on a corner of Sugar House Park itself, where an old Sizzler's restaurant used to be. There's now a plan for a gas station, it looks like, to go there. Can you tell us just basically what this story is about and how they landed on a gas station being there?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the busiest intersections in town. If you drive a car, you've probably gone by this corner at 21st South and 13th East. Been a Sizzler for a number of years, and it's been abandoned for a number of years. The new landowner is well along in designs for a new come and go convenience store and gas station right at that corner next to Sugar House Park, which is one of the region's most popular parks. And there's instantly been concern, you know, almost from the moment this was proposed, about that potential land use clash between a convenience store right at that corner and a well-trafficked park. There's also a lot of worries about how will this affect traffic around that intersection, which of course has vehicles coming off of I-80 and is already a very busy intersection. You know, Sugar House is one of the most rapidly growing neighborhoods in the city, and its community council is pretty, I'm not going to say aggressive, but is dogged in vetting proposed projects in the neighborhood. They've given this a lot of attention. And as you say, there's been a lot of neighborhood concern. A lot of people don't want a gas station at that particular corner. It's a conditional use under the commercial business zoning at that particular location. And under state law, what that means is it has to be approved, although the city Planning Commission can put conditions on it and that's essentially what they're doing. They're putting, you know, extra green buffers around it to try to shield it and making a whole bunch of different design changes based on the community input. But when this comes before the Planning Commission, likely in October, it'll probably be approved.
Wow. It's interesting. I'm the history of the lot itself I'm curious about, because, you know, you have that entire quadrant other than, I guess, Highland High School being part of Sugar House Park. And then there's this just one little carve out corner that isn't part of Sugar House Park. Is there any sort of, I mean, I guess it's just been, has it just been a business forever there?
Yeah. I mean, that has been a privately held lot for you know, quite a while. I don't know very much about the history prior to Sizzler, but it's amazing how iconic the Sizzler use was for a lot of people who just refer to it as the Sizzler site. But yeah, if you look at the plat map, that's been a privately held little corner there at the intersection, zoned for business uses. So the landowner is within their legal rights on this.
Okay. Your reporting is fascinating on this. And then there's also a Building Salt Lake story on the sort of, I guess there was a potential for there to be housing put there. And instead they're going to get this gas station. Robert Gerke, let's bring you in, a news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune. A quick comment on maybe this gas station and on zoning changes before we head to our underplayed stories, if you have a comment on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think the zoning changes, I think they're a little wonky and down in the weeds, but I think the big picture is encouraging because it's important. You know, for so many years, we've limited these housing options, and I think there's a recognition that that's kind of backfiring, that there needs to be, they are a part of it, of the puzzle, particularly for affordable and deeply affordable housing. And as far as the Sizzler goes, I mean, I don't know what you could put there that's not going to be a little bit controversial. It is, as Tony noted, it is a traffic snarl, especially during rush hour, and anything that was going to create more traffic there was going to be, you know, probably cause headaches. You know, I miss my Malibu chicken at the Sizzler, but, you know, I think it is kind of perplexing, though, because you do have a gas station right across the street from it. I guess that's not unprecedented, but, you know, there's, I guess maybe the positive takeaway from this is that it's not going to be sitting there abandoned as an abandoned building anymore, and will be put to some good use and hopefully, you know, an asset for the community.
Robert, why don't you kick us off with a pick for underplayed story of the week, since we are low on time. I'll have you, if you've got one ready.
Yeah. I mean, this morning, Brian Schott posted a really interesting story about Trevor Lee, a candidate for the state house up in Layton, and a secret Twitter account that he had, that he's you know, posted some controversial things, derogatory things toward transgender people, used the DesNat hashtag, and so forth. And he, it was an anonymous account that he copped to. You can check out the rest of it there at sltrib.com.
Okay, worth checking out. Jessica Miller, let's bring you back into the conversation. I'll ask you for a pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, so I was on the show last week talking about the Utah Sheriff's Association booking a controversial ex-sheriff, David Clark. And it turns out they actually did cancel him before he was scheduled to appear this week. The NAACP president, Janetta Williams, really put a lot of pressure on the sheriff, saying that he was too divisive and would undo the work that they've been trying to do over the last couple of years. And so the sheriff's canceled his appearance.
Wow. Follow up to what we talked about last week on the show. Thanks for that pick, Jessica. Leah Larson, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
So mine comes from the Standard Examiner in Ogden. The Marshall White Center there is a rec center that the city built in the 70s in the historically Red Line District. It's like one of the only, if not the only, public buildings in the state named after a Black man. But it has fallen into disrepair over the years, or is what one person described to me, demolition by neglect. But the city council just unveiled plans to rebuild it and revamp it. So looks like they might begin construction on that in the spring, which is great.
Wow.
Kind of a happy story. Yeah.
That's a great pick. Thank you, Leah. I had not seen that. I'll check that out at Standard Examiner. And then Tony Semerat, a quick pick for underplayed story of the week.
I'm going to recommend a story from our colleague Julie Jagg about the these potash canals out in the West Desert that are essentially just kind of wastewater drainage, if I understand them. But they're such dramatic cerulean blue colors that these have become an instant viral kind of phenomenon on YouTube and Instagram and Facebook. Kind of a disconnect between social media and the real world, and fascinating look at that area out there.
Great pick for underplayed story of the week. Jessica Miller took my pick for underplayed story, so I'm going to skip it. But I will thank my guests, Leah Larson, Robert Gerke, Jessica Miller, and Tony Semerat, all with Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for making time for this today.
You bet.
Thanks.
Yeah. And that does it for Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Both of these public radio stations are in our fundraising season, our fall fundraising season. So please contribute to ensure that we can continue to bring you the quality programs you hear on these airwaves. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next week.